You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We get to talk with a lot of smart, talented, and interesting people on Central Time, and we realize that often those people are kids. So we went back in the archives and found some of our favorite interviews with Wisconsin young people from the past year or so.
You know, I remember birthdays being a really important and special day when I was a kid. One of my favorite things was that I got to pick what I wanted for dinner, and I would think about it for a long time, but I'm pretty sure almost every time I picked pork chops and spinach.
And my favorite thing was to go to the mini golf, putt-putt golf, it was at the time, slash arcade plays, and then Coney Dogs afterward. That was our treat. Now, that was great. But for families dealing with homelessness, coming up with gifts or a party can be tough. That's where Leah Hale comes in.
Leah started throwing birthday parties for children at Manitowoc's Hope House Shelter when she was just in second grade. We talked with her when she was getting ready to start high school.
Leah is the founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club, and with the help of a few hundred other volunteers, she wants to keep the celebrations going. We asked her how she got started.
So when I was 9 years old, my mom and I went to Hope House to drop off some donations that my Girl Scout troop had previously collected. And so that day we actually met a little boy who thought all the bags that we were carrying were for him because it was his birthday. So then I asked the director if he was having a party, and she said no, that they didn't have any programs in place at that time that provided birthday parties for the kids. So I just felt terrible and felt like we should do something for him. So then I was talking to my parents and asked them if we could give him a party. So we ended up talking to the director, and then later that same day, she thought it was a great idea. So next day, we showed up with cake and some balloons and a small gift, and that's how the club got started.
So yeah, that was your first one at 9 years old. What happened next?
After that, it just kind of started to grow. We branched out from birthday parties to then special events and holiday dinners.
And how do you have any idea how many parties you've thrown since then?
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. Probably well over 100. There's not a lot of birthday parties each month, but usually only like one or two. But definitely a lot.
And when you throw a party, I understand you try to make sure it's what the kid would want. So you talk to the boy or girl, and why do you want to tailor it to their interests?
I think it's just important because the kid's birthday party is so centered around them, and just kind of that's their day where they just get to have fun and kind of be a kid and not worry about the situation that they're in. So I guess it kind of gives it more of a meaning if it's more of tailored to them and has like the theme that they or something that they really enjoy instead of just like a generic like cake and balloons.
What kind of themes have you done at these parties?
We did PJ Masks, which is super popular right now. We also have done, we had a kid that liked wrestling and dinosaurs. So then we've had it where we've combined like the two themes. So we've had our one and only wrestling dinosaur party. And then a lot of times the party trends just seem to go with whatever in the movie theaters, like Star Wars or Avengers.
And I'm guessing you've done a Frozen party or two?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And what kind of reactions do you get from the kids and maybe even their parents?
I just, a lot of times, it kind of just depends on the family. Some families are very, like, they're very, like, outward with expressing, you know, like, gratitude or whatnot, but some of them prefer to keep it more private and kind of keep to themselves more. But the general reaction is they're very thankful and very happy for the party that was provided for their kid.
And it's not just a one-person show anymore. It sounds like you've gotten other people in the community involved. How are people helping out?
Well, we have over 900 members now, and we also have the local businesses like Cops and Party Pizzazz that do a lot of the help with donations and drives.
So those are members of the Hopeful Hearts Club. When did you turn this into the Hopeful Hearts Club and make it, more than just you throwing parties?
I actually started talking to my second grade classroom about it at the time, and they thought it was really cool. So then I had like the first members there, and then I think just from there talking about it more, and once the community got to know about it, it was a lot more people wanted to join and donate and see what they could do. So we just decided that it would be best if everybody could be involved in some way.
And you mentioned you're doing birthday parties, but you're also doing other events. What all is the Hopeful Hearts Club doing now?
Well, our annual picnic is coming up in June. We also provide baby showers and like holiday dinners for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then we have our, like, drives, like the school supply drive or a food drive. And then sometimes we'll do, like, tailgating parties.
And talk about, you know, you've gotten a lot of people involved. You said 900 members. What do they say to you? Are they getting something out of this, too?
My club would not be what it is right now without the members and their support and generosity. And I definitely think that any volunteer, any person that does give back will say that they do feel very happy because, you know, like, you're not only, like, giving to a person, but you're kind of giving for yourself because it does make you feel really good and make you want to keep doing what you're doing.
Talking to Leah Hale, founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club in Manitowoc, about her work with homeless kids in that community and spreading the word, too. Leah, how do you, you're a busy student, I'm sure. How do you find the time to do all of this?
Lots of organization and lists.
And is this something you want to keep doing through high school now that you're going into school and maybe even beyond?
Yes, definitely. I plan to do it for as long as possible.
And for people listening in other parts of the state thinking, oh, you know, this is something that sounds great. I'd love to make a difference, but what do I know? I don't know how to do this. How would you encourage them to try to do something similar in other parts of the state?
It's just, you don't even have to do, like, any huge thing. It's just starting small, like maybe even going to your local homeless shelter and, you know, providing, like, canned goods or going to, like, a food pantry and donating food there or even just, like, tutoring children for, like, schools, you know. It's not it's one of those things where it's, like, if you start small, it could definitely grow from there and get the ripple effect.
And maybe people in schools, like, I mean, you were in elementary school when you started this. Kids in school might not even be thinking about trying to do something to help people in their community. It might just not be on their radar. Why is this important to you for kids in particular and teens to be involved?
I think just because a lot of times in order to spread generosity in the world, it starts with the younger generation. So I think if we could instill that in younger kids and teens now, then it will definitely help when they grow into adults to be more kind and generous and just have a better working society.
I don't know if you ever encounter this in the world or on social media or whatever. Have you ever run into, you know, when people say, oh, what's wrong with kids these days? Do you ever hear that and think, well, actually, we're doing some pretty good stuff here?
Yeah, so a lot of times I do. It's kind of like one of those things where people, I feel, focus more on the negative. But I know there are a lot of decent kids out there that really are kind people and want to do good in the world.
Isn't that a great story? Leah Hale is the founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club in Manitowoc. She's been throwing birthday parties and doing a lot more for children at the city's Hope House shelter since she was in second grade.
That reminds me of one of my favorite interviews ever, a third grader who wrote a book about her friend with brain cancer.
We'll hear that conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to some of the conversations that we've had with some pretty remarkable young Wisconsinites over the past year or so.
And I have to say, Rob, this was one of my favorite interviews to do. My friend Lincoln tells the story of Lincoln Egger, a 7-year-old West Dallas boy who loves tomatoes and taekwondo and who's also being treated for brain cancer. And his best friend, Nadia Greenewalt, wrote a 36-page book and made the cover art, too. They went into our Milwaukee studio with their mom so I could talk with them. And I asked Nadia why she wanted to write a book about Lincoln.
I wanted to write it because I wanted something to do, and I wanted to help Lincoln.
And why were you thinking that writing the book could help Lincoln?
Because I was trying to give him money to help him pay for medical bills.
So, Lincoln, what did you think when Nadia said she wanted to write a book about you?
I think it was very nice.
And why was it that you had medical bills? What's going on with you, Lincoln?
Because I had cancer.
And do you think Nadia did a good job writing about you?
Yeah.
So, Nadia, what did you want to say in the book about Lincoln?
I wrote about him when he was 2 and what was happening and his treatments.
And Nadia, I heard that you went along with Lincoln to his chemotherapy treatment. What was that like, seeing your friend getting his treatment?
I went there 2 times, and it was, I thought it was going to be scary, but it wasn't.
And Lincoln, the book says that you don't like getting your chemo treatments very much. What's it like when you get them?
It's like that it hurts and it's sick on my port.
So your port is where they put the medicine in you, right?
Yeah. I get headaches and tummy aches.
And Nadia, maybe you could read us a little bit of the book, because I know you have a copy with you. Why don't you read the first page for us?
This is me, Nadia, and my friend Lincoln. I met Lincoln at school, and we used to do Taekwondo together. He's 7 years old, and his favorite color is red.
And what do you two like to do together? Because, you know, I know that you think about and talk about Lincoln's cancer, but I know that you also have a lot of fun together. Lincoln, what do you like to do with Nadia?
I like to play with her and do tag with her and hide and seek.
And what about you, Nadia? What are your favorite things to do with Lincoln?
The same with Lincoln.
And if Lincoln's not feeling too well, do you guys have some things you can do together that's maybe more quiet play stuff?
When I'm not feeling good, I just hang out and chill.
Well, Nadia, do you have plans to write more books in the future? Did you like writing the book?
No. This is my only book and my only book that I will.
Is that because Lincoln is so special? This is the one book you think you want to write?
Yes.
And Lincoln, what about you? What do you think of being the topic of a whole book?
I think it's nice, and I think I like it.
And what do your friends think?
I like it very much.
You like it very much. And what do your friends and your family think about a book being written about you? You're just 7, and someone already wrote a book about you.
They think it's pretty cool, and they think it's nice.
Lincoln, what would you like people to know about kids who have cancer? What do you think's important for people to know about you and other kids that are getting treatment?
Don't be afraid. It's okay.
And so,
they're just trying to help.
And how do you like people to treat you? Do you like to be treated just like other kids?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nadia, what do you think people should know about if they know someone like Lincoln who's going through cancer?
Well, they shouldn't be afraid, and they should always believe that they would be okay.
And if people want to get a copy of the book, where can they find the book, Nadia?
Well, if you go to Facebook and type in My Friend Lincoln, you can ask my mom, or you can go on Gmail. My Friend Lincoln at Gmail.
And we should tell people that Lincoln is spelled L-I-N-K-I-N, right? So they get it right.
Yes.
So you two are friends at school and you've done things outside of school. Do you think you'll be friends for a long time?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes? And even when you're adults, you'll be friends?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, Nadia and Lincoln, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Another great story.
I know. You could really tell how much they care about each other. And I hope Nadia changes her mind about not writing another book. I think she's a natural.
We're taking a look back at some interviews we've done with amazing young people over the last year or so. And we're focusing on high school and younger today. If you know of a young person in your community who's making a difference, email us at centraltime@wpr.org and let us know.
Rob, you got to talk with a member of the Riverside University High School Robo Tigers last spring. They were on their way to the Robotics World Championships in Detroit, right?
Yes, the team was considered an underdog until they won at regionals in lacrosse, and they made it to the quarterfinals in Detroit, which was the best finish ever for the team. I talked with Aileen Fernandez. She's a driver for the Robo Tigers, and we asked her what that means.
Well, basically, my job is to create strategies with other teams, pay attention to what everybody does, and just drive the robot, do my best. I'm thinking about how the robot's going to work, how I'm going to be adjusting to it, and also, like, all the problems we can face in the competitions, and how I can work with it with my team.
And do you feel nervous as you start to roll? Like, what's going to happen with all the hard work you just put in?
Yeah, I feel really nervous at the beginning because I really don't know how is this going to work. Like, how I'm going to work with the robot, drive it, and, like, if I'm going to do good or not.
Aileen, when I was in high school, I think the most high-tech project I built was a toothpick bridge. I hated doing that. Is this robot project fun?
Yeah, this is not just, like, a robotics club. This is also, like, about learning all the strategies, learning about, like, math, science, and also, like, what you can create using your imagination and working with others.
And Aileen, do you see yourself maybe going into some kind of career that evolves? Maybe it's robotics or some kind of engineering or related field?
So I'm thinking between medicine or going to biomedical engineering.
That is so cool.
I know. I could see her or one of her teammates maybe driving something like a Mars rover someday.
I got to talk with a pretty amazing young person who was representing Wisconsin nationally, too. It turns out that Madison is quite a powerhouse when it comes to competing in the National African American History Challenge Bowl. They've actually taken home first place several times.
Who did you talk with?
Jaden Wynn was an eighth grader at Wright Middle School in Madison when he was part of the national champion team. I asked him how he got involved with the competition.
My social studies teacher, he picked a couple few students who seemed intrigued or more passionate about social studies, and he said he does this thing called the African American History Bowl, and so at once a week for like 3 years, we go in and we study a whole bunch of questions, and we just learned a lot. And so then, I was originally going to be the extra, but one of the contestants moved away to Denmark, Soren, and so I had to like step up my game and I had to catch up with Micah, and I guess everything turned out well, as you probably know. And then so we went to the competition, we won, and then after that, like 3 months, it was in April and we left in June. So however many months after that, we had to like study like twice as hard because we had to know the questions in more depth. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we kind of overstudied because like it wasn't that much depth, and like a lot of things that we really studied in depth, they didn't end up being on the bowl, but we still knew the stuff. So that turned out well.
So how much do you know in advance, Jaden? Like, do they give you certain topics or certain periods? Because African American history is a really big field to be studying.
Well, it's a book by Henry Louis Gates, Life Upon These Shores. So he stopped writing it in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected, and it starts all the way back in 1619, where the slave ship, the White Lion, brought the first 16 slaves over from Africa to Jamestown, Virginia. And it's just that entire time period from 1619 to 2008.
Wow, that's a lot. I majored in history. I know that's a big chunk of time to be able to master. Was there a particular time period or group of events or people in that you were studying that you especially enjoyed learning about?
I always like learning about, I liked it all, but I like learning about the segregation in the 50s and like the Great Migration and the movements of African Americans and how they're progressing and how they basically kind of like built up the economy and stuff.
And so, Jaden, it sounds like besides having to know the material, there's also some strategy involved in whether you buzz in or not. Is that something that you and your teammates would talk about?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot because a lot of times it was a trick because they say the question, it sounds like a certain answer, but then if we would just listen to the question, it would be something completely different. But then I just didn't want to give the other team a chance, so like a few times I'd ring it, and then like, but then they'd say like the last two words of the question, it would totally throw off my mind, and then we really had to think, and like one out of the three times it happened in like the one in New Orleans, we got it right, but we won anyway, so I guess it's all right.
So New Orleans, I'm glad you brought that up, Jaden, because the national championship was in New Orleans. Was that the first time that you had been down there?
I've been down south. I've been to Louisiana, but I've never been to New Orleans, and I like New Orleans. It was a very great and interesting experience.
So what was it like? I mean, you competed. You obviously did really well here in Madison that your team got to go to New Orleans. But what was it like knowing you were up against, you know, other really great teams? Did you have a lot of nerves? Or
yeah, we were nervous. So like, before we went, we were like trying to convince ourselves to also have fun. We were just nervous all the time, and so we were just studying, and we just wanted to learn it all in depth. And like on the plane, we were studying, and so but then like when we actually won, we felt pretty good about it because, well, we won, and so then like for the rest of the time, we got to feel happy about it and like not be so nervous. Our like other kind of like tutor type person, Emmanuel, also a mentor of the 100 Black Men. Basically everybody we met that asked where we were going, he'd say, "We're going to a national competition in New Orleans." And he'd say, "What for?" "African American history." And so then flight attendant lady, she started quizzing us and stuff, and we got it right. And then she went on the loudspeaker and like said, "Everybody, these students," and she had to remember our names. She struggled with that, but she remembered our names, and then she just shouted us out on the loudspeaker on the plane, and it was just crazy.
Did people applaud for you?
Yeah, people applauded, and now we wrote a letter to her to tell her that we won because she was really wanted us to win.
So this was on the way down that
yeah,
she did that.
It was crazy because everybody we meet, they say, "Don't come home without a trophy. You got this, guys." Just building up our nerve every time they talk to us. I just look at Mike and Pawan. We just had fear in our eyes.
No pressure, right?
Yeah.
But you did win.
I always believed myself to be a confident person because I'm not a very shy person. But, like, after winning, like, not many things make me as nervous anymore. Like, normally I'd be, like, super nervous to talk on the radio. But, like, being in front of all those people and, like, really studying and just not wanting to fail really, like, makes you less nervous about other things, even if they're, like, really cool, like, talking on the radio or something. So, I guess, I am more confident.
Wow, could we get a grown-up team together? I'd like to do something like that. A lot of work, and I don't know if we could stack up against these kids.
I know. It's really amazing. And you and I are big history fans. So, I mean, we might have a chance,
yeah,
but
maybe.
I'm not sure. It's so impressive what Jaden and his teammates accomplished.
We're listening back to some of the really fun and inspiring interviews we've done with Wisconsin young people in high school or younger.
And coming up, we'll hear from a couple amazing athletes who are pioneers in their sports.
Plus, a young Wisconsinite who's sharing his love of baseball with kids thousands of miles away. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Central Time.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Rob, were you much of an athlete growing up?
Well, it's funny. I was just not too long ago going through some of my stuff that my folks still had, and I found my first grade basketball player of the year award. But I got to say, I kind of peaked early. That was the high point of my athletic achievement. How about you?
I have to say, I haven't heard you talk about basketball, so I thought maybe that was a part of your past. You know, not really. I played Park League softball, but that's about it.
Now, you talked with some pretty impressive young Wisconsin athletes in 2018, including a champion log roller.
Yes. Livy Papadopoulos goes to Holman High School, and she took first place in the Midwest Log Rolling Championships this summer. When we spoke, I asked her to first explain how log rolling works as a sport.
So log rolling is a competition of two athletes on a log trying to knock each other off without touching each other or crossing a line that's painted in the middle of the log. It's best of five matchups, and it's a double elimination tournament, so each match leads on to the finals.
So tell us about the log. Is this an actual wooden log, or are they synthetically made?
Yeah, so they're wood logs, Western Red Cedar, lathe turned.
All right. And so how long and how thick is this log that you're trying to stay on top of? Because you're trying to knock the other person off, but you're also trying to stay on yourself.
Exactly. So the logs are about 12 feet long, 12 to 13 feet. And you start on a big log at the beginning of the competition. And if you and your opponent both stay on for a certain amount of time, then you head to a smaller log. And if that goes a little bit long too, then you head on to the final log, which is the smallest and spins the fastest.
Wow. So are you barefoot or are you wearing some kind of shoes?
We wear spiked cleats, which dig into the log and keep for good traction.
So how do you start? Because I imagine getting on a log the first time, you fall off right away whether anyone's trying to knock you off or not.
I was not talented in my first log rolling class, not at all. I started log rolling just like any kid picks up any sport. I saw it and I loved it right away. So
how do you learn to stay on the log? How do you get started?
So I actually do coach log rolling at a couple different programs around the La Crosse, Wisconsin area, but for beginners, it's the same thing every time. It's actually really not too much about the balance. It's about teaching your feet how to be able to control the log underneath you and to be able to keep yourself up and keep up with the log when it starts going fast.
It almost seems similar in some ways to learning how to walk on a tightrope.
You're
really learning how to connect with that little bit of material that's keeping you from falling.
For sure, yeah. It's really not too much about the balance, like I said, but that's definitely plays into it. It's, of course, a lot about the footwork getting started.
So you might not have been great when you first started, but you've certainly been on quite a roll, pun intended, in the log rolling world lately. Can you tell us about some of your recent victories you've had?
So as an amateur log roller between the ages of 12 and 16, I won 5 amateur world championship titles, and I was planning on going for my 6th this year, but I learned that I was qualified this year to compete professionally, so I decided to take the jump this year. I've competed so far in 3 different tournaments. I won all 3. I started out this summer at the Midwest Championships in Madison, Wisconsin, which was a pretty deep field. I won that. And then I also won the U.S. Open, which was held in Michigan this past July.
So you are really, I mean, you're at the top of your sport.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I'm really looking forward to competing again. Honestly, sometimes I feel like I'm just getting lucky. I work really, really hard at what I do. I work at my craft. I keep myself in shape. I take nutrition into account. But at the same time, the people that I'm competing against are incredible athletes. They're so toned and they're so fit. And the way that they can move themselves on the log is incredible. And it's so great to be able to keep up with these people.
Well, as you said, I mean, any athlete, especially an athlete at the level that you are already at such an amazing young age, I mean, you really should be very proud of yourself. It is a lot of hard work, and it's a sacrifice, I'm sure, in other parts of your life to devote the time and energy that you need to this. What is it about log rolling that you love so much that you're happy to make it such a centerpiece of your life?
I really just love to do it. It kind of goes back to when I first started. I couldn't wait to go to log rolling class once a week, you know, and I still love it exactly the same way. Of course, I love pushing myself and working hard throughout the summer, but some of my favorite parts of log rolling is when we get to the end of the summer and the tournaments are over, and I just get to go mess around and have fun on the logs at the end of the year.
Just do it without having to worry about, you know,
Absolutely.
What it's doing to your rankings.
Yes.
So we've talked a little bit about the physical aspect of it, and that balance is important, but it's really, you know, learning to relate to the log and kind of be one with the log. What about, you know, is there any kind of mental aspect in dealing with the opponent that's on the other end of that log? Is there any kind of, you know, psyching each other out?
Stylistically, every log roller is a lot different. There are people that are smaller but really fit and tend to have marathon type matches. They go for a really long time with each other, try to outlast the other person. There are other people that are really, really strong, and they're able to kick the other person off, of course, without touching them. They kick the log and they spin it as fast as they can and really, really sprint and use that power that they have. Personally, I don't know if I would fit quite into either category. I think I'm a little bit unique when it comes to my style of log rolling. I definitely use my strength to my advantage. I do a lot of lifting to prepare, but I also sometimes try to wait it out a little bit and see what I can do to take advantage of the other person.
We talk about like core strength and balance, especially for older people, you know, prevent falls. It seems like you'd be using a lot of core strength when you're on that log.
Core is actually a big key in log rolling. You really want to have a strong core because you're pulling yourself back up, back and forth, you know. And when you're switching directions, then your core is your main spot in your body that you want to keep tight and focused in.
Is this a sport that's popular in other countries? Where are kind of the hot spots for log rolling?
Right now, a lot of the best pro athletes actually do come from the Midwest. However, there are people all over the country that compete and all over the world as well. There are new programs starting all over the world right now. There's a company called Key Log Rolling that's starting programs in different countries that didn't have access to the types of wood logs that we use, so they use synthetic logs, and right now it's really, really growing at a fast rate.
So, Livy, you're in high school now. Yes. You have gone pro in log rolling. How do you see your future and your future log rolling coming together?
I plan on log rolling as long as I possibly can. Usually people leave their prime in their late 30s, early 40s, but I want to see if I can make it that far, if not farther. And of course, even when I'm done log rolling competitively, I want to keep log rolling for fun and keep teaching it for the rest of my life.
Wow, so you see at least 20 more years of competition.
That's my hope.
Wow. Well, we'll be watching you. You're making waves, again, pun intended, at a very young age. For those of us listening who might be a few or a lot of years older than you, is this a young person's sport, or should anyone give it a try just for fun?
Everyone should give it a try just for fun. They have classes all over the place in Wisconsin right now that have adult classes and beginner classes for kids. I'd love to see more people try it out around the area.
Isn't Livy a great ambassador for log rolling? She's got such enthusiasm for it, and I can't believe she's competing at the pro level while she's still in high school in Holman. Have you ever tried log rolling, Rob?
I'm sitting here alive talking to you, Judith, so no.
No, that'd be a big no. Yeah. I have to say, I used to belong to a gym where the treadmills looked over the pool, and I think Friday evenings there was a family log rolling thing.
Okay.
And I am so uncoordinated that trying to watch the log rollers and walk on the treadmill, I almost fell off the treadmill.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Well, you talked with another amazing Wisconsin high school athlete last year, one of the first female wrestlers in the state, as I understand it. If I remember correctly, she was the champion of her weight class at the Badger State Invitational Tournament just a little before that interview.
Right. I talked with Alexa Flores when she was a senior at Madison La Follette High School and in her fourth season of wrestling. And I asked her how she got interested in a sport that's typically geared towards boys.
For 3 years before I started wrestling, I had watched my brothers wrestle, and I always had the itch, but I never really pursued it until I started seeing Ronda Rousey. You know, she started getting really big, and I was like, Dad, I want to do that. And he said, all right, well, first you have to start wrestling so that you get a strong base for something before we can pursue anything else. So, like, the next day I was right in the gym practicing with the guys at La Follette.
So you've been doing that for almost 4 years. What's that been like for you?
It's been really good. You know, I have a lot of support behind me, like my coach Dante Sciro, Jim Radwell, and then my previous coach, Gary Skiles, and all the teammates are awesome, and my parents. So.
And what about your friends? What have they had to say about it?
I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of, they think it's cool and unique. And I guess they see it more than I do, but
you've competed against both boys and girls. Are there different strategies that you use depending on who you're wrestling against?
I would definitely say yes. I mean, wrestling with the guys, they biologically like have a lot more upper body strength and stuff like that. So girls have to more rely on their technique more and making sure that we get in on a shot and, you know, finish with it right away. And some moves you can't really necessarily do on girls because they're very flexible and they can squirm out really easily. So it's just interesting to see the different styles, per se.
Have you noticed boys wrestling against you differently than they do against other boys? Do they have to make those same kind of adjustments when they're wrestling you?
I would say yes. But, you know, there's different types of wrestlers, so, you know, one, they could come out just the same. And some people, they're kind of antiquated, and they see, like, oh, a girl, it'll be an easy match, or, you know. And it's just good to go at them and, you know, prove them wrong.
Do you think it's important for girls to have their own division to be able to compete in?
For sure. I think that with the pilot of this program and other programs, hopefully it'll be substantial and that the numbers of girl wrestlers will flourish and then create different opportunities and avenues for wrestling in college and just having that opportunity for girls to be on a more equal platform.
Do you think there are other girls your age or maybe a little older who, if they had seen girl wrestlers, might have thought, oh, that's a sport I'd like to get into?
Definitely, definitely. I have people that talk to me, like younger people who want to, and I just tell them, go ahead. And other people are like, dang, you know, I only had a guys wrestling team. I wish I could have done that. So, yeah, just having the opportunities there will definitely increase the numbers.
And Alexa, what do your brothers think of you following in their footsteps?
I don't know. It's just kind of the whole family's involved, so we cheer each other on. And, you know, when my brothers are out there, my heart starts beating just as much as when I'm on the mat. So I think everyone around me is very supportive, so I love it.
It's got to be a challenge to be one of the first girls to be wrestling. I loved how she talked about how she changes her strategy depending on whether she's wrestling against a girl or a boy.
Yeah, and it was so great to hear how her dad encouraged her and basically said, well, that's what you want to do. Here's how we're going to get you there.
Support can be really important, and sometimes it can come from an unexpected source, like a Green Bay teen who's been collecting baseball equipment to send to Africa for the past 6 years.
We'll share his story after this break. Stay with us on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Sports can be a great way to bring people together and a way to build bridges.
Max Bobolts is a teenager living in Green Bay. And in 2012, he was watching the Little League World Series. He was really impressed by the Uganda team and decided that he wanted to figure out a way to share his love of baseball and the necessary equipment with kids in Africa.
So what did he do?
Well, let's let Max explain.
So, like you said, I was watching the Little League World Series. Uganda was representing Africa for the very first time in the history. And they were doing stories on kind of how the team got to where they are and how they played at home, stuff like that. And they showed that they all didn't have shoes or they were sharing gloves. Not everybody on the field had a glove, no uniforms, hats, stuff like that. And so I saw that need, and it was just an idea where I just wanted to send my equipment, my friend's equipment in our garages that was just collecting dust, and send that over to those kids so they could play. And then it's grown to a little bit more than that.
just a little bit
just
more.
Just a little bit, yeah.
So I have to say, I could see a lot of people watching that and thinking, oh, that's really too bad, but not having that urge to say, I'm going to do something about this. And you were young, weren't you? About 12?
Yeah, I was 12 years old when this idea happened.
So you started fairly small, like you said, you know, what was in your garage and other people's, but clearly it's grown beyond that. How did people respond when they found out what you were trying to do?
Yeah, so early on, it was a lot of our friends, family friends, and their friends, stuff like that. Them hearing about it by word of mouth, and they would call us up to say they have equipment to donate. Then it got bigger, grew throughout the city, throughout the state, and now we're pretty much throughout the nation.
So how many pieces of equipment have you sent to Africa?
We have sent just about 10,000 pieces of equipment.
Wow, that is a lot.
Yeah.
And I have to say, having shipped things overseas before, sometimes the cost of sending something can be more than what something is actually worth. How do you actually get the equipment over there?
Yeah, so initially me and my mom, so I've been to Kenya 4 times, and the first time me and my mom, we brought 19 suitcases worth of equipment. And so it was just me and her and a Rotary Club that we went with. And we had 19 suitcases all filled with baseball equipment. But since then, we've been in contact with a group in Connecticut, American Friends of Kenya, and they do a shipment every year with their stuff, and they let us have a part of their 40-foot shipping container to send baseball equipment over. So we do that every summer. We usually do two drives out to Connecticut from Green Bay to deliver some equipment, and then when we go in the summer, we'll bring some as well.
So you have, as you said, traveled to Kenya 4 times to deliver equipment and also teach baseball. What was that first trip like? How old were you then?
I was 14 the first time I went to Kenya.
And what was that like?
It was definitely life-changing. I hadn't even been in high school yet. I had really no idea what life was really like about and what the meaning of it was of any kind. I hadn't even thought about it. But seeing the kids like play a game that's so foreign to them and so like common for me. It was really cool to see that. And also the other thing that stuck with me was that they're just like me, you know what I mean? At the time I was 14, like I said, I was stressing about school, what classes I was going to take in high school, stuff like that. And some of those same kids in my peer group in Kenya were having those same stresses. So that kind of made the world a lot smaller.
Wow. And you clearly love baseball. What are you hoping that the kids in Kenya and other parts of Africa that you're bringing the equipment to and the game to, what do you hope they'll get out of it?
I hope that they just kind of get what I got out of it. I was never really the best player on my team ever. I was just a guy that liked to play the game. So what really stuck with me with the game is the smarts that it takes to play it. And I just loved all the lessons that you learn from playing baseball. So that's what I would say that I hope they see, is just the lessons and the intelligence that it takes to play the game.
We're talking with Max Bobholz right now. He's the founder of the Angels at Bat charity, which he started when he was 12 years old. And Max, you are really connected to Kenya now. It started with Uganda. What have been some of the challenges in working within these African countries where governments and infrastructure sometimes are maybe not the best for getting equipment, for instance, or traveling?
Yeah, we've had a couple of challenges. The first challenges was definitely getting the equipment there. We had no idea. We had no African connection at all, let alone like a specific Kenyan or Ugandan connection. But now I would say it's more, there's a little bit of a language barrier issue, and that's partly why I'm studying Swahili at UW-Madison, is to break that language barrier and be able to communicate with them. But it's also to kind of make sure that they're keeping up with the game. They keep playing it while we're not there. And while we're training them there, we don't know for sure whether or not they're playing it while we're not there. But then we have people there that give us updates, and they are playing it now, yeah.
So are they organizing leagues? So they have, I mean, it's one thing to play, but you need someone to play against for it to be really fun. Are they organizing leagues so they can, you know, keep it going?
Yeah, definitely. We've been in contact through the whole charity's growth with the president of Kenya Little League and all of Kenya Little League as a whole. And so they are kind of the group that is organizing tournaments, teams, getting the equipment out there, stuff like that, to make sure that baseball in general is growing throughout the country.
Max, you founded Angels at Bat in honor of a baseball coach of yours, Todd Willequette, who took his own life in 2012. What aspects of his coaching and his mentoring, his outlook on life, do you think that you carry forward in this charity work that you're doing now?
Yeah, it's definitely, he always believed in us. No matter how good we are, no matter how skilled we actually were, he believed wholeheartedly that we could do great things. And so I would say that that's one thing. No matter if the kids can even hold a bat, if they're disabled in any way, we believe that they can do it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And what do you think he would think of Angels at Bat?
I think that he would be pretty proud. I think he would probably giggle a little bit at how it's changed me.
And how has it changed you?
Yeah, like I said before, I was just 12 years old when I thought of the idea, and then 14 when we first went, and now I'm 19 years old now. So I would say it's made me more rational, just not getting stressed out about the little things, because there's a lot more worse things that could be going on in my life after seeing the poverty that some of the Kenyans live in.
And Max, what would you say to a young person, maybe someone 12, maybe someone even younger, who see something? I think young people have such a sense of justice and empathy. What would you say if they see something that they want to make a difference on?
Yeah, I would say just work hard, be determined. Like I said, it was just an idea that I had to just send equipment there. But for 2 years, I did not want to do anything but send equipment to Africa. So with the hard work that brought with that determination, we were able to make an idea into an actual organization. So I would say to just acknowledge a need, see a need, something catches your eye, and then work for it. Don't let it stop. Don't let the drive stop.
Over 10,000 pieces of equipment so far. He started at 12 years old. That's amazing.
I know. And it's so great to be able to share these kinds of stories on Central Time. What's it like for you, Rob, to get to talk to these great young people?
It's fantastic, inspiring. You know, I'll editorialize a bit. I don't have a lot of patience with the whole, these loser kids today mentality. We've had that mentality for thousands of years. I am inspired to talk to younger people and hear these stories that we're hearing today.
And it really makes me feel like we're in really great hands in the decades to come.
Fingers crossed. Stay tuned. There's more Central Time to come. We've been hearing a lot about young people getting involved in the world around them. Here's a story in politics and government. A 9-year-old in Severance, Colorado, heeded a call from his town's mayor.
On a field trip, Dane Best learned that there was a local law that made snowball fights illegal. He decided that he was going to change that.
Here's his mom, Brooke, describing Dane bringing the issue to the town board.
The town board called him up to the podium, and he had a little PowerPoint that he prepared, and he was very official. He had a clicker, and he clicked through his PowerPoint and read all of his points that he wanted to get across. And then the town board and trustees asked him a few questions. And then afterwards, they brought it to the town board vote, and it was a unanimous vote that they would take snowballs out of the bylaw, and he had his law passed.
Dane did admit that his real incentive was to be able to legally throw snowballs at his 4-year-old brother, but he did leave us with this inspiration.
It doesn't matter how old you are, you can change a lot and have a voice in your town. It doesn't matter what age.
So that's pretty cool. He's saying any of us, no matter how old you are, you can change things.
That's inspirational. But I hope, Judith, that you're not now inspired to ambush me on the way out of work with snow here in Wisconsin. I mean, there's a lot of January and February left to go.
There is. You know, you might want to watch your back.
All right, I will. I'll be watching.
Stay with us here on Central Time.